This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, this week we are going to talk about the state of the state, both in the sense of the governor's recent address and in terms of Arizona politics. We have with us two reporters from the Arizona Mirror, Jeremy Duda and Jim Small. Jeremy has been here before. Jim, I don't know if you've been here or not.
It's been a long time.
But that could be. We've been this in our sixth year, so that's entirely possible. My memory doesn't always go back that far. Why don't you – and by the way, we will be joined in the next segment by Craig Harris, who's been doing a lot of reporting for the Arizona Republic, mostly on the subject of education and charters. For openers, why don't you tell us what the Arizona Mirror is, because it's an interesting and somewhat new enterprise.
Yeah, so Arizona Mirror is a nonprofit news organization, and really we are focused on state government and politics and public policy. And in particular, I think really what we are trying to do is to cover public policy, which I think is inherently boring to most people. I think all of us in this room really like public policy and really are engaged by it. But it's hard to get people to understand what the effect of policy changes are going to be on their lives. And so what we really want to do is to tell stories about public policy and about the changes that legislators and city councilors and governors are considering making and what sort of an impact that's going to have on the day-to-day lives of Arizonans. So we're really trying to kind of have an outside-in approach to covering the state capitol and state politics as opposed to really covering it in a way that speaks to the people who are already engaged and are already a part of the process.
I will endorse you in that I am a daily reader.
Thank you.
A subscriber, your price is right. I'll say that.
Yeah, we are free. We have no ads. We have no paywalls. We have no pop-ups that are going to, interfere with your ability to read the news. We've got a daily newsletter. We've got a Facebook page. We've got a Twitter feed. And we've got a website that I think hopefully is something that can provide people with a kind of a clear, independent and sort of investigative view of what's happening at the Capitol and how it affects people.
If you want to keep tabs of what's going on, there's you can subscribe to a daily email, just a page. You can scan it and five or six articles typically, and then links if you want the full story.
That's it.
So go a little bit more. And so it's a very succinct read, therefore.
But thank you. Our goal is trying not to waste people's time.
All right. So the governor's speech. What's your big takeaway?
There was a lot. We heard a lot of kumbaya. The governor has talked a lot about bipartisanship and hoping everyone works together. That might be a little bit overly ambitious based on some of the stuff that's going to be on the agenda. The governor, in terms of ambitious stuff, the governor did not lay out a lot. He laid out a couple of pressing priorities. First and foremost, the drought contingency plan the state must pass by January 31st to avoid the federal government kind of taking charge of some pretty critical water policy involving Lake Mead. Talked a lot about I think the budget is going to be a big fight. The biggest budget fight you see at the Capitol are when there is extra money to spend and there is more than this year than we're used to
seeing. Times are good right now.
Yeah, times are good, but the governor wants to prepare for when times are not going to be so good, which is inevitably going to happen. He wants to bolster the rainy day fund, which is about $462 million right now, to as much as a billion.
Which would require a legislative authorization, because that's over the percentage amount allowed.
Right. State law caps the rainy day fund at 7%. I think the billion would probably get it up to somewhere around 9 or 10. Now, this seems all good and well, but the problem is there's a lot of people with a lot of ideas on how that money is going to be spent. You have $200 million in ongoing revenue. A lot of that is going to be committed to these teacher raises that the governor and the legislature pledged last year. For the rest of it, I mean, there's the rainy day fund, but there is a near $1 billion rollover in the K-12 budget that Speaker Rusty Bowers and Senate President Karen Fann want to address.
Explain $1 billion rollover. What's rollover mean?
Basically, an accounting gimmick where you hold off on paying one month's expenses until the next month.
You pay next year. Yeah, this year's expenses after the end of the fiscal year.
You post date the check. You balance things on paper, and for budgeting purposes, it works. But in reality, you're still behind the eight ball. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of money there. And the Speaker and the President want to pay down at least some of that. There are a lot of school infrastructure needs, one-time expenses that legislative Democrats are very interested in. And legislative Democrats, especially in the House, are probably going to have somewhat of a greater seat at the table than they're used to having, because we are looking at a 31-29 House. Republicans lead by only two votes. This is the closest, narrowest margin they have ever had since the Republicans took control of the House in the 1966 election. They have not relinquished control since then. So the Republicans can't.
I think one of the most interesting questions to me is, does 31-29 mean the Democrats get to play? You, as you pointed out, there was a lot of lip service to doing things in a bipartisan fashion. I heard Representative Charlene Fernandez, and I've heard some other representatives say, you know, if you're serious about that, you get us involved on the front end, not just talk to us at the end when you need a couple of going fishing for a couple of votes at the end is not bipartisanship. It's only bipartisan if we're at the table from the beginning.
Sure. And that's going to be a problem if they try to do that. Like, one Republican falls off in the Senate and they're out of luck on anything divisive. And a lot of things, I think they're going to have to count on that potentially happening at some point. They're not going to be able to start off with a Republican-only plan.
But do you see them going to the point of engaging Democrats from the front end? That would be a change in government.
I think it depends on the issue. I think if you have issues like water, yes, I think that they're already engaging Democrats to at least some degree and to a greater degree than we've seen in the past. When it comes to the budget, old habits die hard, and Republicans have controlled the state legislature and the wheels of power here for a long time.
Longer than anybody down there can remember.
Absolutely. You know, and so I think that the natural instinct of Republican leaders is A, it's what they normally do is just deal with all Republicans, and B, it's conceding that you've lost some power, I think, when you have to bring Democrats to the table right at the beginning. And I don't foresee that happening. And I think that, you know, the fight over this budget, over this, you know, roughly $1 billion budget surplus is going to be the dominating thing for the session. And it's going to be ugly. I mean, I've covered 14 or 15 legislatures. The biggest fights are definitely when they have more money than they know what to do with. That's when you have a lot more fighting over the money.
You got something worth fighting for.
You do, absolutely.
And we will talk about that. In particular, I'm going to start out. Craig Harris will join us in the second segment, and we will divert a little bit specifically to the subject of education. I think it was one of the it's loomed large, obviously, in recent years, and Craig has written a lot about that, and it looms large in terms of the agenda of the state because, if you're talking about a $1 billion surplus, there are those in the education establishment who figure that's about the amount by which they've been shortchanged historically. And what happens with that money will probably be one of the most interesting things to watch in the session upcoming when we return in the Think Tank in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We've been talking to Jeremy Duda and Jim Small from the Arizona Mirror, and Craig Harris, Arizona Republic, is with us. You've been writing. Are you the education reporter? You sure been writing a lot about education.
No, I'm an investigative reporter. Focusing a lot out on education just this last year.
Gotcha. Well, we talked about the governor's state of the state. I want to make an observation about that. In a way, this speech was conspicuous for what it didn't say. There's a $1 billion surplus, and we were looking to see whether or not, that some of that would be devoted to what education folks have said has been has been, if you want to return to the 07-08 levels, there's ballpark a $1 billion short. The most interesting statement I saw in there, the governor says, and this is quote, "It was just 8 months ago we delivered a 20% pay raise to hardworking teachers. To anyone out there considering using these resources somewhere else, I have one message. Don't even think about it. These are raises the teachers earned, and the raises we're going to fulfill and protect." Who is it that was saying that we weren't going to do that? I mean, I think you were talking. There was a kind of a straw man there. I mean, that's what was promised. So what he's in effect saying, and conspicuous that it was his sole statement, we're not going to renege. Given that we got a $1 billion surplus, we're not going to renege on the deal we made last year.
Right. And there wasn't I've not heard of anybody who says we're not going to give the money to the teachers. It's essentially a pass-through.
Yeah.
You know, the governor didn't even – it's curious his speaking because he didn't want to give this 20% raise just a year ago. He was content to give the teachers a 1% raise. Only when thousands upon thousands of teachers quit on the job and struck, then all of a sudden he came up with this 20 by 20. And let's be very
clear. By the way, real personal in this room, in two consecutive days in this very studio, he said, we only got 1%, would like to give more, came back the next day and said, well, we got 20%.
Right. And I would love, I think my wife and my kids would love that if I said, no, we don't have money, then all of a sudden I can find a big portion of my budget.
He felt the heat. He felt the heat. To his credit, I mean, he owned it. He recognized that he had something he had to deal with. He was certainly not an early advocate of it. It was kicking and screaming. But when he recognized the handwriting on the wall, that there were significant powers allayed in the other direction, he went down and found the money.
And let's be clear. He's not delivered on the full amount. You are right. Give the governor credit. He came up with 10%, which is a big raise for almost
nine.
Anybody.
I think it was really. There was some 1% one-time thing.
In there.
It's a stretch to even call it 10. It's
right.
Nine.
It's nine, but it's nine plus the one gives you 10.
And then you got five for this year and five for next. But he's kind of double counting because he's saying, well, we delivered a 20% raise. No, you didn't deliver a 20% raise. You delivered 9 or 10.
Correct.
And now part of the deal is 5% this year. And so he's like trying to kind of take double credit for that.
Well, and if he wanted to actually go through with this, with you have a big surplus, you could perhaps give the full 10 this year and say, okay, we're going to give it to you early. Now, if the economy goes south next year, we're done.
That's the problem. That's why the teachers weren't entirely happy with this in the beginning, because there was a commitment made ultimately to 20% over 3 years. But there was no funding mechanism to ensure it. In 07, 08, they found that they were the first people cut when economic finances took a downturn. We're not in a downturn this year, but next year's anybody guess.
Correct. So things could go south. And the governor, to his credit, wants to throw a lot of money into the savings account, the rainy day fund. Mm-hmm. Someone said it's a little more than what you need. Yeah. So I think, like, you know, our fine folks here have said earlier, I mean, there's a lot of people who want some of that money and away from education. I think Senate President Karen Fannis said, hey, we need to also take care of correctional officers. They haven't gotten a raise in 12 years. We need to get them a raise. And so there's a lot of state government agencies and employees who also want raises.
I think that notion about raise is not unique to correctional officers. State employees have not gotten a raise.
Some have. I mean, the governor's office.
Oh, the governor's got.
I mean, I don't know. I'll tee you up on this one, Craig. But I mean, you know, certainly there have been raises, but they've been generally more for appointees and not for rank and file.
That's a completely different class of person.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's tens of thousands.
And I think that's also where people get entirely misimpressions about how much state employees make. When you're looking at governor's appointees, those people get the bigger salaries. The people who are working at the DMV and corrections and most of those other places in state government. Well, you want a sense of how they're, you know, how they're paid. There's a huge, huge brain drain from the state of Arizona to the city of Phoenix and to Maricopa County. People are leaving the state to go to the city and the county because they get paid a lot more in those latter two places
for
the same jobs.
Well, unless, of course, as you said, you work on the ninth floor, and if you work for Governor Ducey, you are taken care of completely with very big raises, very big promotions, you know, with sizable increases, and his directors across the board have also gotten big increases too, that teachers or rank and file employees have not seen.
This doesn't do anything for a rank and file worker to know that their boss's boss got a big raise.
Right.
You know. So nothing for. But basically, the other stuff, the other unmet needs in education, basically, he was conspicuously silent on. You know, what about class sizes? What about, you know, overall level of a separate allocated funding to give the 5% that was promised last year, but pretty much silent other than that.
I mean, my takeaway from the speech was that teachers are going to get their raises. Don't worry about that. Don't ask for anything else. You know, we're not gonna be pouring a bunch of money into the K-12 system, whether it's for capital or, you know, in terms of buildings or soft capital in terms of classroom supplies or even in terms of just an increased base level funding for for schools to be able to hire staff and to decrease class sizes and to do all those things. I mean, I think it was a pretty distinct impression that that was that that stuff's not even on the table.
It's kind of back to normal,
which gets back to bringing Democrats to the table early, and those will obviously be priorities for the Democrats.
That's your observation about you know, if everybody's at the table early, those things get discussed. Sure. If it's all Republican until the last minute, we need to find two votes. Then that doesn't get discussed.
And this goes back to a matter of resources. And the governor's comment you mentioned about to anyone who wants to use that money for something else, you know, no way. And, you know, we talk about $1 billion+ surplus here, but most of that is one-time money. You can't use that for ongoing expenses. We're looking at probably about $200 million in ongoing surplus revenue that you can use for things like raises for correctional employees or for teachers or ongoing funding for really anything. And so that's a pretty limited pool. The governor, I mean, we have even Republican senators talking now about the need to, they feel the need to raise taxes to generate more revenue for stuff like this. Senator Sylvia Allen is talking about increasing.
And she's a conservative.
A very conservative senator from Snowflake is talking about increasing a 0.4 cent sales tax to a full penny to generate, you know, more than $500 million, maybe $600 million more for the budget. Even Senate President Fan, also fairly conservative, signing on to this. The governor, I mean, from day one of his administration, from his original campaign in 2014, really put his foot down on, you know, read my lips, no new taxes. So that's going to be a big fight if they really try to push that.
That therein, we will pick up the subject of taxes next when we return in just a moment in the think tank.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
I want to throw out to all you guys for general discussion. It seems to me that in the governor's speech, one of the most interesting things was something I think that wasn't discussed at all, literally, but really it was the underlying principle of a lot, which is taxes. He has had a pledge, no new taxes ever under any circumstances. I think that's the reason for wanting to throw surplus money into the rainy day fund. I think that's the reason for being sort of minimalist about funding for education. He's not going to renege on the 5%, but he's not offering anything else. I think he's saying, if I can keep all of these other expenditures to a minimum and put as much as I can get away with in the rainy day fund, then I'm never going to be faced with that situation where I've got to go to the legislature and say some tax has to be raised.
Well, yeah, but it's interesting because as Jeremy brought up earlier, you've got Sylvia Allen, who, by the way, is involved with charter schools up in her neck of the woods. She's even proposing to raise the sales tax by 0.4%, which is almost like bizarre to hear a right-wing conservative.
She's far right.
She's far
right.
So that's
why this is not like a liberal Democrat proposing.
Right.
This is,
but I think what she's seen as she has been involved with her charter school, that charter schools and district schools, all public schools, have been hurting. And you start the year, there's over 1,000 teachers that have left their jobs this year. It's not like things are rosy and better because we got the 10% pay raise for teachers.
We're still – I mean, we're not – I mean, we moved up a little bit, but we're still near the bottom.
Right. We're still near the bottom. We're still losing a lot of good teachers, and we're still losing a lot of folks who are saying, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to deal with this. And so I think when you have conservatives who are saying, well – times are good. Maybe we can convince people to let's inch that up, sales tax, just a smidge. Then maybe you're going to get other folks to get behind it.
Sure. And the way that Senator Allen's looking to do this is she wants to send this to the ballot in 2020 because you are never going – first of all, you need a two-thirds vote in the legislature to pass
which you're never going
to
get.
Which you're not going to get. And if you do get that, the governor's going to veto it because he has made his pledge ironclad. I mean,
so it's got to be a referral to the voters. But it would be a big deal for the legislature to refer it.
No, absolutely. Absolutely would. I mean, the last time they did this, it was Jan Brewer fighting, you know, tooth and nail for a year to get the legislature under the most dire of economic circumstances and, you know, massive unprecedented budget crisis. It took her a year to do that. Now, if this happens now, it would be not only without the governor leading the charge, but with the governor probably actively opposing it. But if they do this, this could head off something that Republicans would like even less. I remember last year we were very close to having a pretty income tax hike for top earners on the ballot, and it was kind of a technicality to get that thrown off.
But it was a technicality, and that proposal was widely supported. It would have passed.
I mean, who's to say? I mean, there would have been a massive multi-million dollar campaign against it. But when it comes to a tax hike, I mean, Republicans are going to like that a lot less than a sales tax.
Because here's the point about that. To the extent that Republicans are representing more higher income voters, a sales tax is regressive. That people who pay the most of a sales tax proportionally are people at the lower end of the income scale. That income tax proposal was targeted specifically to those in the highest income tax bracket.
Sure, would not have affected lower earners just only
at all.
If you made individuals making more than $250,000 a year.
I forget the number, but it was targeted. It established a new bracket for the very highest income earners.
Sure, and I have no doubt we're going to see a renewed push to put something like that on the ballot for 2020 by some of the same folks, maybe crafting it maybe a little bit better than before so it doesn't have some of those technical issues that got it kicked off the ballot. But we might see competing proposals on the ballot in 2020, a sales tax, an income tax. And then you put someone like Ducey in a very tough spot, and a lot of the Republicans in the legislature in a tough spot. Now,
you could even see something happen like happened with the original King Day proposal. There were two proposals on the ballot, and a majority of the people voted for one or the other of the proposal, but each of them went down.
Sure, and we've seen that
the
a lot
got split.
Sure, and we've seen that a number of times where you have competing proposals where the legislature is trying to see something coming that they don't like, and they try to head it off with kind of a watered down version. In this case, it might behoove them to kind of get out in front and try to head something off, like an income tax hike or something like that. Try to head it off before it gets any momentum. We'll see how much support that gets in the legislature, especially since Democrats are not so keen on a sales tax hike, as you mentioned, a regressive tax. They've really. They're not a fan of it. They prefer the income tax, something more progressive.
But I think when push comes to shove, the Democrats have gone along with sales tax for education, even though it's regressive simply because of where the benefits go.
Sure. In the past, they have. If there's an income tax hike for top earners coming back to the ballot, maybe they throw in their lot with that instead.
And as I said, my read of the polls on that was that it was widely supported.
Initial polling that had kind of been circulated showed it had a really good starting point.
They were terrified that it was going to pass.
Well, people always want to get someone else to pay the taxes, and whether it's right or not, if you want to soak someone who's rich, that's always a very popular thing. Well, it's not necessarily the most fair thing but it is the easiest way
to get passed. It also would have been a particularly easy moment to do it because you were applying that tax specifically to the group of people who had had their federal taxes reduced by a whole lot more than the increase in Arizona taxes would have. They still would have been ahead of the game net.
Absolutely.
So that would have been a particularly opportune time to do it.
Yes.
So all things considered.
And when you looked at the dynamics of the last election in November, where you have, Kyrsten Sinema winning, you have Kathy Hoffman winning, you have Katie Hobbs winning, you have Democrats winning statewide elections, and you have the Democrats getting 29 members in the House. It was I don't know if you'd call it a tsunami, so to speak, but you have a pretty good blue wave that came to Arizona that you had not seen for a long time.
It was almost as much as the Democrats could have hoped for. I think there were a couple of Senate seats that were very close that they might have in their dreams have hoped for. But given recent history and how long it has been since the Democrats had taken over either legislative chamber to get close. I mean, close in the House was a complete surprise. Nobody was looking for that. They were looking at the Senate. And they came close in a couple of other seats that would have brought that potentially into play. To have won a couple of statewide races, plus Corporation Commission.
Correct.
Three statewide races, including Secretary of State, which now hampers the governor. He can't leave for extended periods of time. He can't take an appointment in the Trump administration.
Hey, Napolitano did.
Yeah, and she hasn't.
She
hasn't dared set her face in the state since, has she?
has very anybody? Little, yeah.
I mean, talk about who would be target number one at any Democratic meeting. Her name is Mudd as a result of that. So, that constrains Doug Ducey. So it was, and as it was nationally, it was an interesting election to watch because there was an impact of time. The early returns looked like, where is this wave that's been promised? And it took almost 24 hours for, it was a very slow wave, but by the time you counted the votes, they'd picked up 40 seats in the House, and it didn't look like that in the beginning of election night. So the last thing I want to pick up, and we'll take a break before this, but among other things, I would like to talk about one of the big enduring issues here is water in the state. And we will pick up that and some other topics when we return in a couple of minutes here in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Jeremy Duda and Jim Small from the Arizona Mirror, Craig Harris from the Arizona Republic, and Jim Small, I think of the four of us, you probably know the most about. All I know about the water thing is I think we're running out. We live in the desert, and that's a perennial problem. So it got semi-solved in 1980, but they're back for another round. There are competing interests. The farmers down in Pinal County in particular, the home builders who want to build homes with impunity, Phoenix residents who want to water their lawns. Here's the weird thing that we got about this. I understand we have until January 30th to have a complete plan submitted to the federal government, and nothing's even written yet.
Yes. And that was what the governor called for in his State of the State speech. He talked all about, this needs action. It needs bipartisan action, and it needs really swift, decisive. You know, you've got to move quickly. We've got about, 16 days or 14 days, whatever he said. And the clock is definitely ticking on that. Basically, the way it works, what this whole issue is about is what happens with Colorado River water and what is the state's plan for dealing with this ongoing drought that we're in, which is where I think we're in year 19 or year 20 right now. And water law is very complicated. Arizona's at the bottom of the pecking order in terms of who gets water from the Colorado River.
That's because of the original deal.
We
wanted the CAP, and we gave up some rights to
that. Was it. So, California gets water before us. Nevada gets water before us. Colorado gets water before us. And so we're at the bottom of the food chain on that. And the idea is when we have a water shortage, and which is inevitable at this point. I mean, we're cruising toward it very quickly. When that happens, what is the plan within Arizona to conserve water? And essentially what it boils down to is how much are we going to save and who is going to get less of the water that we currently use? One of the big fights right now has centered, and we saw a press conference on this recently in reaction to what the governor said, was, Pinal farmers are saying, look, we don't want to be the ones that are getting the short end of the stick here. And within Arizona's water rights, Pinal farmers are basically the ones who have the least amount of rights to any of this water. They get the water last. A number of years ago, there was a settlement that was entered into regarding some Indian water rights, and the Pinal farmers gave up some water for that they had been getting. And now they're looking at a situation where they say, look, we might lose 30-40% of our water. And if that happens, you're going to start having farms that close and you're going to have fields that are basically left fallow. And that's going to be bad for the economy. It's going to be bad for us. It's going to be
catastrophic for some people.
It would be. Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that if that situation were to happen, you would have farms and farmers who would go out of business. I think there's probably no way around that. And so that's one of the issues. You have rural issues that are involved in it. You do have city municipal issues. You've got, the governor's office spent much of last year in trying to deal with this, really setting up a fight between the executive branch and the Arizona Department of Water Resources and the Central Arizona Project, which manages all of this water that comes from the Colorado River. And its elected board. It's a board of folks that are elected from Maricopa and Pinal counties to basically determine how is this water going to happen. And they set up, this fight that really lasted for most of last year. And now they seem to have kind of put their differences aside and figured out a way to coexist and work together. But now the issue is really going to the legislature and trying to get the legislators to sign off on this package. And this is a difficult thing to do because, as you said, no one has seen what the proposal is. It's not like there's draft language floating around. I think you've had leadership in the Arizona House and House Speaker Rusty Bowers who said, look, if I don't have this like basically now, basically yesterday, how are we going to be able to act on this? And we're not going to have enough time to duly consider it. If Arizona goes past that deadline at the end of the month, what happens is the federal government basically says, okay, well, we're going to write the plan. This is all assuming, I suppose, that the federal government is open and that anyone is there to do this.
Another wrinkle.
And to recognize this. But the federal government says, okay, well, we'll just write a plan. And all of the other states, California hasn't yet. Nevada and Colorado that have submitted their plans, those plans basically get cast aside because the federal government says, fine, if you guys can't all agree on something, we will go ahead and we will agree for you and we'll implement a plan for every state.
And do we have any idea what that would look like?
No, I certainly don't have any idea. I'm not sure that the water stakeholders here in Arizona have really had much discussions with the feds about it. I think that is the most distasteful option, you know, and
because it's scary if you have no idea what it's going
to
be.
It is, and you take yourself out of basically being able to determine your own fate. You know, to turn that over as a state and say, here, we're going to let the federal government decide how we're going to have water, which is, I mean, we live in a desert. We need water to survive and for our economy to work. How, you know, I think it's really irresponsible, frankly, for the state to say, we just can't agree. We can't find some kind of consensus. So we're going to let the federal government do this for everybody.
In fairness to the federal government, this was not something they imposed on January 1. This has been a deadline that's been there for a long, long time.
Absolutely, which is why it was, you know, puzzling to watch last year's fight over basically over territory and over who had authority to say what and do what. Because, you know, I think essentially what was going on was the governor's office and the Department of Water Resources wanted to do things in a way that CAP and the Central Arizona Water Conservation District would not do. And so they decided, well, rather than try to figure out a way to work together, we'll just go to war with them and we'll have this fight. And, you know, if we win in the end, then we'll be able to implement our own vision. And I think ultimately they didn't win and they had to find some kind of compromise.
Sounds like a mess.
It is absolutely a mess. It's extremely complicated, but it is extremely important to everyone in Maricopa County.
Fortunately, the average person isn't going to think about it until they turn the spigot and there's nothing coming out.
And by that point, I mean, we are
the farmers are way ahead of that because they've got vested interest and livelihoods at stake.
They do. And it's going to be years and years down the road, even years and years into a drought situation or into a water rationing situation before Maricopa County even feels the pain like that.
Okay, the other big topic that we haven't hit as yet, and it's out there. I want to turn this to you, Craig. Charter schools hardly mentioned in the speech.
Actually, well, it wasn't mentioned in the speech.
Yeah.
There was a somewhat reference to oversight, but the governor did not even mention two simple words: charter schools, which is curious considering that the Attorney General's office is working on legislation because they want more oversight. They want to have an ability to go in and look at the books a little bit better.
I think probably a response to some of that stuff you've been writing.
I think so. I think when you have—
There was a reference. It was a bleak reference. He didn't say charter schools, but he did talk about school choice, which, of course, is code word for charter schools.
Right. And what folks are talking about with reforms is not changing school choice. No one is saying, basis, we want you to stop with your AP curriculum, which is giving you one of the best rankings in the country. What people are saying is that basis, we would like you to open up your books so we see what your $10 million management contract is paying for at a time when your founders are buying an $8 million condominium in New York City and you're crying poor and saying we need our parents to give us $1,500 per kid because we can't pay our teachers.
And you're paying your teachers less than our public school teachers, and they're among the most poorly paid in the country.
Right. Charter schools in the main pay their teachers thousands of dollars less, $7,000 to $8,000 less than district schools because of extremely high overhead costs that's gone unchecked. And
they get to hire people who can't qualify to be teachers in the regular public schools, uncertified teachers.
Well, there's goods and bads that they aren't certified, but there's also an argument to be made that if you spent your entire career as a lawyer and you retire and you want to teach law, you should be able to do that. So there is some fair
I agree on that point. But if the lack of certification is primarily a vehicle to bring any old warm body in there to teach, so you can pay them less, then it's a problem.
Well, that is an issue. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I have no problem with, a retired Intel engineer wanting to teach mathematics. I don't think you need a teaching certificate to do that. It's at the high school level. Certainly it's subject matter expertise that matters.
That's right. So what is going on is the governor has not put anything forward as far as reform. The only thing that we've seen or what we've heard is that he might add a few more regulators at the state charter board to go out and to make sure charter schools aren't lying about their enrollment and to goose the budget to get more money. But the governor, in a minor sense, only added four more regulators. The charter board's saying we need at least eight, and that's still not enough. So you're having a tough time getting folks, at least getting the governor behind this. You have the attorney general, who's a Republican, calling for a lot more reform, a lot more openness. The new school superintendent, Kathy Hoffman. And then you've got everyone kind of turning to Kate Brophy McGee in the state Senate because she's kind of designated herself that she wants to bring about more transparency and more openness and opening up the books. And so everyone's kind of going to her, but then you have the Charter Association, which is very powerful. They represent the 544 charter schools. They say they're going to come out with their own reform, but from what I'm hearing, it's pretty much window dressing. It doesn't really do a whole lot to stop.
You say they represent the charter school. That means the charter school operators.
The charter school operators who have made millions upon dollars.
This is the fox guarding the hen house.
In a lot of ways, yes, yeah. That's what would be happening. So, so the problems that that we've been writing about is you have got charter operators who have become multimillionaires by engaging in the nice term is called related party transactions. The more basic term is self-dealing, mm-hmm. where you're buying things from yourself, you're giving yourself no-bid contracts of worth millions of dollars, and you have school boards of the charter association that have been created by the operator. So you don't have an independent group looking over at these schools. So that's kind of a big thing at the legislature right now that Democrats have not been able to get past in the last few years. They're going to try to forward to get a little bit more oversight and regulation and transparency.
Okay, you have the final word. We're going to talk in this session about charter schools. Maybe we'll get their education for sure. Water. And this thing we didn't get to, which is interesting, is criminal justice. That'll be a topic of another show upcoming. I want to thank you all. Jeremy Duda, Jim Small from the Arizona Mirror. How do you subscribe, real quick?
AZMirror.com.
Okay. And Craig Harris, Arizona Republic. Subscribe to you is going to cost you.
It's going to cost us.
But it's a bargain.
But it's worth it. But it's where you thank you very
everyone,
much.
Everyone should subscribe.
Yeah, everyone should subscribe to all and the Mirror also. We need your help.
Absolutely. We'll see you next week in the Think Tank. Thank you all very much.